And hello, good people of the internet. It is I, Tommy Kelly. This is Adventures in Woo Woo. And welcome to the second episode of the all new, all singing, all dancing, all shining, etc., etc., Adventures in Woo Woo, in which I, Tommy Kelly, and nobody from Ireland, talks to you about his adventures in woo-woo, or his adventures in living a life through the lens of spirituality, magic, creativity, and all of that kind of stuff. So I want to say, first of all, thank you very much for all the amazing feedback in the first episode and all the support and all the words of encouragement. You all are wonderful people and I appreciate you more than you could possibly know. It was really nice to be able to come back and to have that kind of reception, and it makes it easier then to go forward thinking that, well, at least some people are enjoying this or finding some sort of value in it. So in this episode, and it could be a long one, I have a lot I want to talk about. It's kind of a continuation, an update, or further developments of a post I made on the newsletter last year, which was called The Universal Disciple and the Light Magician. And it's around my ideas, my cosmology of what is happening quite here, and what we are meant to be doing, why it is the way it is, and all of those, you know, big question type things. And I'm certainly not presenting it as it's the defining answer or the word of God or the word of the goddess or anything like that. I'm not even presenting it as something that I may hold on to. It's a snapshot of where I am right now, and I'll explain why I'm in this position and why I believe these things currently. But again, like I was saying in the last episode, I want to be as open to all possibilities as possible. But yet, in putting this all together and getting my thoughts together on this and trying to put it into a coherent type of presentation, say, I did learn an awful lot, and I learned an awful lot but what I don't believe and what I do believe, and, you know, grey areas where I'm unsure of. So even in that, it was valuable. So hopefully it will also be valuable to you in some way, even if it is just to reflect back thoughts you already have, or that you go, well, I completely disagree with that, and therefore it, you know, it encourages or bolsters up your own opinions that you have about all of this anyway. So that's kind of all the preamble I want to say. And yeah, let's get into it. So there's going to be at least four parts to this episode. That may change as we go along. There may become less parts, there may become more parts. But the structure as I see it, as I start out, is that this first section will set up the other three sections, and it'll also explain and situate and contextualise the three visions that I want to talk about within the other sections, so that it doesn't come across as what it's not. I want to be try and as truthful and honest as I am about all of this stuff. And so I think if I just went straight into and these visions, that it would kind of paint a picture of something that I'm not trying to present. I also want to talk about a difference between insights and initiations. And that will lead us then into the three parts of what I want to talk about, which is the Lord, the Lady and the Child, or the Father, the Mother and the Child again. Or soul, matter, spirit, a host of different names that represent the same thing. And within each section of that, there is a vision that I've had or an experience that I've had that has informed that section and has kind of molded or pushed me in the direction of why I have these kind of worldviews or cosmological views, or why I feel it is the way it is and why it isn't other things, you know, why I don't subscribe to other people's cosmologies or traditional cosmologies, because I try as much as possible to, you know, be guided by my own experiences rather than someone else's dogma or experiences or preferences or proclivities or any of these type of things, while taking all of that on board, of course, because I will have blinkers and blind areas and stuff that other people will see that I just won't. With these visions, however, I don't want to present them in any sort of way that it's something that is special to me, or that I'm in some way of higher order, or I have access to something that you don't have access to. These visions, particularly two of them, one of them is a bit more peculiar than the other ones, are just very straightforward, active imagination type stuff. And these things and these experiences and these spiritual kind of insights or whatever are available to anyone who does the work. You know, you start meditating, you start working on yourself, you start doing the studying, and this stuff will start happening. And one of the things that I found, including myself in this, is that there is kind of a point where you can either not take these serious enough or take them too seriously that they become, in a sense, a dogmatic thing in your head that you just can't, you know, go away from it. You know, these are divine inspiration, so I can't dispute it or I can't disagree with it. And I think it's helpful to disagree with everything, or at least you look at it from an angle of, well, what if it's wrong, you know, and just to test it out, just to make sure and just to understand it from all different sides. Two of them are active imagination, but one of them is certainly active imagination or shamanic journey in session proper. It's part of the journey year-long shadow working that we do on the Patreon, in which we use a different servidor or a different team every month to look at a different aspect of our lives to try and uncover where we're being a bit of an asshole, or where we're failing in some way, or we're not living up to our potential, or, you know, there's some sort of shadow work that needs on us. Just have a real kind of look at this thing. And as part of that, there's a weekly active imagination journeying session. And all that really is get yourself into a meditative state with an agenda or with some sort of reason to do so. And then, for me anyway, it's just literally describe the images that appear in my head. And I just have my phone sitting beside me and I just record them. I say them out loud as it happens. And some very interesting stuff can happen out of that for me. I know some people have a real hard time with visualizing and stuff, but I think that the statistic I read recently is that only 1% of people cannot actually visualize, and the rest have some form of it in some way. And I suppose the one thing that you can do to kind of kickstart these things is to start actively imagining something like a beginning scene, be that a campfire, or a cave, or going underwater, or something like that, and then just kind of trying to let your mind go. So that's one of them. Another one of these visions came as part of Scrying the Aethers, which is a whole episode, I suppose, on itself, but it's 30 particular places that you scry or you look at, which, as it goes along, kind of become more, I suppose, refined. These are different aspects of either different aspects of the world, or different aspects of creation, or different aspects of God, or something. I found when I was doing them that about the first 25 of them so seemed to be more preparatory, or were preparing you for something, or kind of getting you in the mood, or not necessarily the mood, but getting you in the mode, understanding it. And then the last five, maybe six, were, you know, where the real jewels were, and they were quite intense. It's part of the Enochian system of John Dee and Edward Kelly. Lon Milo the Cat has a great book on it. There's plenty of YouTube things you can look at. Or if you're on the Patreon, then you can listen to all of my sessions. This one in particular that I want to talk about was quite intense, quite sad. And at the end of it, I was kind of sitting there crying for quite a long time. But it's quite relevant then to what I want to talk about. So I want to include it. But again, you know, you can do the aethers. You can scry these aethers. It's not a closed thing. It's not something that's not available to you. It's not something I was able to do that no one else can. It's something that maybe you might want to do it, maybe not, but it's certainly open to you. The last one is harder to explain, but again, it's part of the notion that if you start doing this work, if you do the meditations, if you do the study, if you do the self-reflecting, if you do all of this, then these things kind of happen. And this was an experience where God or divinity or the part of my mind that is divine or whatever it is, it presented itself as God, came and had a chat with me one Saturday night while I was watching documentaries and drinking some Guinness, and laid some very profound statements on me that have really kind of shaped and become very true for me. And I talked about it in different places, but I want to relate it a bit more to this kind of Lord, the Lady and the Child thing that we're talking about today. I might do where I'll put together like a bonus episode for patrons, where I'll actually do have the recordings of the different scrying sessions or imagination sessions and put them together. And there's an episode of Tasta where I talk about this experience of God showing up. So I put that together as a bonus episode if the patrons want it. I think one of the dangers, though, of these type of experiences, particularly the ones that aren't, you know, that just kind of happen rather than you're, in a sense, trying to provoke them or work towards them in a, say, like an active imagination setting or a shamanic journeying setting or descrying or whatever it is that they can, you can lend undue weight to them. And there's a thing that happens, and it's very obvious, very obviously happens. And it's kind of, I see it almost as a stage in the path. It's like part of the hero's journey. You have to do it. At some point with these experiences, you're going to be told you are the chosen one, or you are special, or that you have some particular message to give, or some particular place in the world, or something like that. And I honestly think that this is, if not an initiation, it's a mini initiation. It's a, like, I was going to say it's like a test, but I don't think it's a test, because a test kind of sounds like it is something that is done in order for a reaction to happen. These things happen, and if you react in a certain way, then, you know, you're demonstrating a certain level of attainment, for want of a better word. And I think this is the main difference between initiation and, say, insight or awakening experiences. Because you can have an insight, you can have an awakening experience, you can have a vision or a sensation of non-duality or of duality or of God or whatever it is. And it can kind of, you can kind of go, well, this is has made me this type of person. And, you know, I know don't fear debt, or I now have an insight into the world, or I now know a bit more about me, or something like that. And it is an insight, and it's an awareness and something like that. But an initiation, I think, in a way, is an event or a crisis point or something like that which occurs, and then it's your behaviour demonstrates whether you actually understand the insight or the awakening or whatever it is. You know, that it's kind of, you can have ego debt taking a load of mushrooms, and that'll be a deep insight, and it can inform your life and it can deeply influence your life or whatever. And you go, I'm not scared of debt. I understand debt from all sides now. And then someone very close to you can die, and you can fall apart and realize you don't really understand debt or anything close to it. Or you're, you know, someone close to you can die, and you can bring the insight that you have, and it informs your action, and you behave differently because you actually understand the nature of debt or whatever in this example. And I think being told you're the chosen one or you're special, whatever, is a kind of a very early mini initiation, I suppose, just to see, you know, the good stuff happens after that, but it only happens after that if you reject it. Because again, I don't want to say test, but test is probably the best word. It's you know, just kind of seeing how will this person react to having knowledge and power and spiritual insight. Will he or she go off the rails and think they're Jesus, you know, or the next Messiah, or will they have, you know, will they be able to take it on board or whatever? It's like in Patanjali talks about the, you know, the cities, the powers or whatever that have come as part of meditation, part of his system, and kind of talks about them and explains them, but then says, yeah, don't worry about them, you know, just ignore them for the most part. And, you know, that's kind of what I want to say a bit about the visions, particularly this one I talk about when God shows up, is not to ignore it, but, you know, don't take it overly seriously that you think it means that you are in some way special. One of my favourite quotes, and it's from Bono, of all people, and he talks about there's two different types of musicians. One of them, they'll play you a song, and they'll go, isn't that song good? And the other type, they'll play you their song, and go, aren't I good? And that resonated with me an awful lot at the time, and I think I kind of bring that into my spiritual life, in that, isn't that experience brilliant, rather than, aren't I brilliant because I've had that experience? So yeah, that's just a long and short kind of way of saying that these things are open to everyone, but just be careful around them, that you don't kind of buy into it too much, but also don't ignore them. You know, they can be helpful, they can be true, but they're experiences of the mystery rather than something that is saying something special about you or important about you. And the more you're able to kind of, at least in my experience, the more you're able to not get carried away with your specialness, which is hard, man, the more it's open to you. And that's what kind of the first, one of the many, many initiations, one of the journeys that you go on, seems to be at some point you are going to be told you're special. You're the chosen one. I just wanted to mention, because it would feel remiss of me to mention that all of this experience is open to you too, without that caveat. So I think that's all I really want to say about this introduction. The next three sections will be about the father, the mother and the child, and there'll probably be some wrap-up section at the end. It'll be quite rambly because there's no good place to start this conversation. There's no good starting point, and they're all kind of overlap, intersect and correlate, and so there'll be a bit of jumping about the place or whatever. So please bear in mind that, again, I'm not presenting this as truth. It's a snapshot of where I am at the moment. It's certainly not my own unique idea. It's informed by a number of things, a number of different ideas, a number of different outlooks or whatever. And yeah, so for what it's worth, here's the snapshot of the Lord, the Lady and the Child. The Lord. October 2nd, 2021, I was sitting alone on my couch watching some documentaries. My son and my wife had gone to bed previously. It wasn't that late, relatively. I suppose it could have been sometime between maybe 11 o'clock, 12 o'clock. That certainly wasn't 1 o'clock. And I had finished watching a documentary called God Knows Where I Am, which is a really heartbreaking documentary about a woman with a mental illness who locks herself in an abandoned house and essentially waits for God to save her. You may guess how that ends. But it was really nice, and not nice, but it was really heartfelt, and, you know, affected me deeply in a way that it felt profound on some level. Then for whatever reason, the next documentary that was on the line was some kind of Christian, or you know, attempt at doing something like The Secret, I suppose, like a big documentary that will become popular, and it was just about God and God the Father and stuff like that. And all I really remembered is something about a cliff, really, to be honest. It was a great documentary. But the reason I was watching all these documentaries, because at the time in the podcast, the Tested podcast, we were doing it, reviewing or talking about or discussing a documentary every week in order, you know, just to generate conversation. So I was watching an awful lot of documentaries at the time. So this was quite a normal, standard evening for me to be having of a weekend. And I had a couple of cans of Guinness, not a tremendous amount. You know, I shouldn't have been driving or anything like that, but I certainly wasn't going to be waking up with much of a hangover or anything like that. And it's hard to explain these kind of experiences to someone who hasn't had one. But the best way I can describe it is the room changes, the energy in the room changes. You know something's about to happen. Sometimes these can be signposted for like a couple of days or even a couple of weeks. You can feel that there's a kind of a momentum towards this. In this case, there wasn't a momentum towards it at all. It was just, oh, right. It's almost like the room sinks, or the pressure changes, or the air becomes a bit more, I don't know, you become aware of the room really, really. There's a thing, if you've ever taken any kind of like LSD or mushrooms or something like that, it's that kind of a notion of where, you know, you just start realizing that you're tripping or something like that, and that you just, things are starting to get a bit strange. There's a realization. It's similar to that, but it's not that. And it's something I've talked about before in the old version of the podcast, where when me and my sister, when we were kids, up until we were teenagers, we would have an experience that we called that place, where this kind of sense of the room changing and being watched, or an awareness comes into the room rather than your watch. That's kind of it. And it happened so much that we came up with the name of that place, where we go, are you in that place? And it'd be yes, invariably. So I can't probably accurately describe this, because it was happening in my head, but at the same time, it was happening outside of my head as well. It was like God walked in, or someone, I'm just going to go with how it presented itself. I'm not trying to, you know, make any claims any other way. And it was a kind of a sense of, I knew where he was physically, walking down, coming down the steps, walking down, sitting down beside me. But like, I mean, I wasn't seeing him with my eyes, but I had a sense of that was happening, and I could kind of see him in my mind's eye and stuff like that. But I wasn't just imagining it. This is the thing, because it just sounds crazy. Like, I can't describe it. If you've had an experience like that, you know exactly what I'm talking about. And he just came in, and I've been really kind of wrecking my brain over the last, oh God knows how long at that point, about why is this happening? Why is this? Why is the world the way it is? What is that we're meant to be doing? I was very deeply unsatisfied with the idea of the world as an illusion, or that we were some sort of mistake, that it was, you know, that we had fallen into ignorance, or that we were God ourselves who had fallen into ignorance for some reason, or that we were deciding to be ignorant in order to play some game. All of those kind of standard spiritual stuff that's probably encapsulated in like A Course in Miracles the most, where it's like we had one mad idea and all of this started. And so there's no satisfying ending to that, because it all ends up back where it was. And so the whole thing is pointless. Where if it's a God falling into ignorance, the whole point is just to get back to where you were. If it was a humanity falling into ignorance or making a mistake, it's come back to where you were. And that feels very pointless. But I am aware to not mistake my preferences for, you know, meaning that that's the truth. You could find the truth and not like it, and I'm aware of that. But it's deeply unsatisfactory in the sense that it's not that, though. And on some fundamental level, that is not necessarily just my preference. It just, this is wrong. That's not it. And I've been struggling with that, because, you know, I couldn't find a satisfying answer to that. So anyway, this guy, and he looked a bit like a, you know, how you imagine a Greek would, you know, with sandals and like a, what's the thing? The cloth, not a Torah, that's a book, whatever it is, the toga, the thing wrapped around him and stuff like that, and his kind of shaved head, bit of a beard, very kind, very warm, very loving. And so what he said to me is that we are divine, but we're not the divine. We're in the sense that God and us are separate. It's not God having this experience. It's like he says that the relationship between the divine and us is the same as the relationship between me and my son. And he kind of pointed to where my son had been sitting earlier on the couch beside me. And there was this kind of, you know, to kind of ponder on that kind of thing, that it's not, while your son is you and, you know, my wife, he's a completely different thing. He's a separate entity, like made in our image, but not the thing. And I kind of felt that on a level. Yeah, I don't believe that we are God. You know, I know it's the kind of standard spiritual thing of the last kind of while, is to believe that we are secretly God. And I have massive issues with that, mostly in the way people talk about it. A lot of that to me is just kind of ego, you know, I'm really good. You know, or something like that. But I don't think that's the case for everyone. But when it's kind of combined with the this world isn't real, it really very quickly gets into spiritual bypassing territory that of you know, none of this matters, none of this cares. I'm secretly God. I don't have to work on myself. You know, let's bring on the end of the world and get this over with kind of thing. And he was suggesting that, you've seen, by creation, by this kind of process of creation, we learn to know what he knows. Which is an interesting thing, and I'll come back to it in a minute. I'll just more finish what the vision is and then expand on it a bit. And he said, this is the place in which he woke up to. It was like this when I found it, man. You know, that to even to God, this was a mystery, this place. And it's interesting to say that because I came across a quote, I find it, that's from the Rig Veda, which I really like. Whence all creation had its origin, the creator, whether he fashioned it or whether he did not, the creator who surveys it all from the highest heaven, he knows. Or maybe even he doesn't know. And I kind of didn't really know what to do with that for a while. And when I wrote about this in the blog post, I think I got it wrong because I kind of inserted stuff into it from a theosophical point of view, which I am, you know, sometimes a theosophist of ideas into that. It was kind of not really what I said. So I kind of had to come back and kind of just kind of sit with that rather than trying to fit it into my kind of scheme of things. And the big thing that he says about it is like, because I said, why is there sadness? Why is this? And his answer was, because that's the nature of the place in which we find ourselves. And that's been wonderfully liberating in many ways, in that it's that's just how it is. And that's kind of, you could, many times in my life would have been completely and utterly you know, not fulfilling what forever, but it's on some level it goes right, okay, at that time I was willing to accept it. And it's not to say that the whole place is suffering, the whole place is sad, whatever. That's just what this is. So, you know, it's the nature of rain to be wet. It's the nature of the sun to be hot and shiny. I mean, that's just what it is here, you know, and to keep looking for an answer is implying that something is wrong with it. You know, why is there sadness here when there shouldn't be? Why is there suffering when there shouldn't be? And he's kind of saying, no, that the nature of the place is that that's where that happens. The nature of sugar is sweetness. It's not that there's anything wrong with it, depending on what dietitian you ask. That's just what it is, you know, and it's like, kind of go, why is it sweet? You know, it's just because sugar is sweet. That's the answer. And I've been spending a lot of time with Edwin Bryant at the minute, who's just wonderful. And he makes a great point of that. No matter what philosophy you get into, no matter what religion, no matter what kind of outlook you have, there'll always be a stop point at some point that just goes, that's just the way it is. And you either agree with it or you don't. And a lot of time that is unfulfilling. But in some way, when he said, this is the nature of the place in which we find ourselves, very freeing, and okay, I could understand that. And that's not to imply that the entirety of this world or existence or creation is suffering in the way that some translations of the First Noble Truth is, or unsatisfactory, or dukkha, or whatever it is. Saying that that is part of it. It's one of the things that goes on here. And that to try and look at it as if it's a problem, if it's something wrong, it's as if it's something gone bad, it's just kind of missing the point. In some way, I kind of likened it when I was writing the post, because it seems to make sense in some way, is that it's like a furnace, you know. In order to create something, you need pressure, and perhaps the suffering is part of the pressure. But we'll come back to this idea of suffering when we talk about the mother, and I'll expand a bit more about what I think on that in relation to the Trinity. So that is the kind of vision that was informing when I started looking exactly at this relationship between the Father, the Son, and the Mother. And I go, so what is the Father then? What in this relationship, this triune Trinity? And why I came to that is, I'm not really fully sure, but it's probably coming out of, the Trinity in so many different religions, but the actual Father, Son, Mother thing is definitely coming from my studying with the Arcane School and Theosophy. That's part of their outlook, where you have the Father, who is spirit, you have the Mother, which is matter, and you have the child as the soul. For me then, looking into this, what I feel the Father is, or what it represents, and forget about the gendered wording of this if it's annoying. It's just a kind of traditional way of saying these things, or it's a good reflection or whatever. So to visualize the Father is like inert potentiality. All the possibilities of everything. All of the things, but absolutely no way to do anything about it. You know, completely inert, totally and utterly in the stasis or in the state of potentiality, but not manifested, not revealed, not done, nothing happened, no action, just inert potentiality. There's a thing in the Bhagavad Gita which is talking a bit about Maya, which is the illusion or the nature of the material world. And there's this thing in it called the three gunas. And I've kind of seen if in all of these things that there was a macro and a microcosm version of all of the different things, then things that work on one scale should, in theory, then be working in, you know, in a different way and a different scale. And so I was looking at the three gunas, which is seen as this is me, this is Maya, this is the thing that you're subject to when you're having a physical life. And the first one in it, and the kind of the lowest level of it, if you want, is tamas. And a lot of people absolutely won't agree with me comparing these kind of tamas, rajas and sattva to the father, the mother and the child. And on different days, I probably wouldn't agree with it myself. But it is interesting that tamas is, some of the words that it's used to describe it is darkness, inertia, inactivity, dullness, but it's lethargy as well. And when it's applied to your life, it's more of a thing of, no get up and go, no passion, no will, not wanting to do anything, laziness, lethargy, all that kind of letting the world happen, that, and it's the lowest level of the three gunas. But it's interesting that it does in some way kind of fit in. It's like a lower order version of it or something like that, or a higher order version of it, whatever way you want to look at it. So in summary, I suppose, of the father or spirit, I would see it as darkness, as potentiality, as inert allness. It's all the possibilities, but it has no way of manifesting. Spirit, but inactive. It's passive. Can't do anything but anything. It can't manifest anything. It can't self-express. And its longing, or the thing that wants to complete it, or the thing that it needs, would be to have self-expression. So it is the darkness inert, infinite potentiality, longing to self-express. The lady. So the vision I want to talk about with regard to the lady or the mother or matter or active intelligence, as it's called in Theosophy or in the Arcane School, the Age of Wisdom. It's quite a recent one. It happened during the journeying active imagination sessions that were from the Magus, which would be February of this year, 2024. And there was a lot happening, a lot of different things that have probably no relation. But it's interesting that the order in which I went back and listened to these almost had a sequence to it that, had I listened to in a different order, wouldn't work. There was a correlation between some symbology that I'll come to around a rat, which comes up a lot in my visions and dreams and stuff, which probably says a lot about me. But I ended up in the vision, a form of Shiva brought me to the water's edge, because he was after saying, it's about time you woke up. And I was going, okay, but how do you do that? And there's other things, he's like licking sap from a tree, and I was going, well, I don't even know what that is. So then he just brings me to the water's edge, and you have to picture, it's very grey, there's trees, they're all black, it's very misty, there was an old black rowboat that I had to get into, and there's some sort of city or something on the other side that I was meant to go to, and it's misty and cold, and it's creepy, and it's like, how you would feel that if I died, and you were met by debt, I suppose, going across, this would be very apt. And strangely enough, who does turn up? Only debt in another boat. And she comes towards me, and she's definitely female. She's carrying a baby, and the baby's also dead. She's like a skull, skeleton, kind of rags, bits of rotten flesh and stuff, and so is the baby. She gets into the boat with me, and she is so loving and so tender and sweet, and she puts a hand up to my cheek, it's really fondly loves me, just, and she's shown me her baby, who is a dead rat, but she loves it. She's singing to it, all of this kind of, really deep sense of sadness to it as well. Her baby's dead, her child is dead, and she's holding on to it. And this kind of vision, I didn't really understand it for a while, but it became more and more important as I was unpacking this whole kind of Trinitarian, the Lord, the Lady, and the child. That this was the mother, because I've seen it as death, but the mother is death. And there's a thing that I certainly have done, and it's very prevalent in spiritual parlance and circles and stuff like that, is this kind of notion to be very down on the material universe, to be very anti-material. And that's fair in a sense, because there's a dysfunctional thing of materialism. So big time. We'll come back to that in a bit. But, you know, and I think this is the kind of a notion that really annoyed me or unsettled me or made me unsatisfactory about the notion of the world is an illusion. The world is something wrong, something you have to escape from. The world, you know, plug me out of the matrix. It's really a simulation. All of these things to be anything other than actually be in the world, you know, or to feel that the world is real. And is important, if not more important than your, you know, your real life in some new earth or some other place, in some other heaven or some sort of, you know, awakening experience that brings you somewhere else, somewhere out of here. Everything is to get out of here, away from it. And it's like to see then that this unbelievable, if you want, sacrifice of the mother in that all of her children die. Everything dies. Everything goes away in her. If, you know, there's just the kind of notion of that you transcend or whatever, or when you die, you know, your body doesn't come with you. The mother doesn't come with you. You know, everyone leaves her, everyone dies, everything is temporary. You know, her child is dead, but she still loves it. You know, and it's heartbreaking in a sense then to see it as a kind of huge sacrifice of a divine mother. And then what we do with it is try to get away from it, to try to say it's not real, to dismiss it, to say that the more important thing is somewhere else, that our real life is somewhere else, that this is a thing to be shunned, this is a place to get out of it as quickly as possible. It's a mistake. And there's something deeply heartbreaking about that kind of realization, that of the mother giving everything and all the pain and suffering and sorrow, and we just kind of dismiss her or want away from her. And even in stuff like Buddhism, where it's kind of saying all is suffering and how to get away from it and stuff like that, it's still this move away from the mother. And it is true. Like, I mean, there is, you know, life is unsatisfactory. Life is temporary. You know, the three characters, other than there's no self, which I fundamentally disagree with Mr. Buddha about that. You know, that is, things are temporary. Things fall apart. Things, you know, everything is dissatisfactory or suffering or whatever. And what we've done with our spirituality and our religions is to do everything to not look at that, to get away from that, to move away from that, to find a path away from that, rather than looking at the mother straight in the face and looking at the suffering. And I mean, there's some stuff in Christianity which is quite good around this, in the sense of that Jesus goes down into hell after, you know, when he dies, and not to do anything, but to bear it, just to look at it, to look at the suffering, to look at the pain, to look at all of this and not turn away and not reject it, not to whatever. And there, even the Passion of the Christ, there's a great kind of vision that stuck with me. Even it's the most violent film I think I've ever seen. When Mary at the end is holding Jesus, and just the look she gives, and that kind of look really embodies what it must feel like to be the mother when you have sacrificed all of these things, and for us just to turn away. And then in my visions or in my kind of feelings around the mother, or the goddess or the lady or whatever, she always seems to have her eyes closed. Now, I'm not fully unpacked what exactly that means, but I think it could be something around the notion of that if you're not looking at me, I'm not looking at you, or something like that. I don't think it's necessarily a punishment. And I mean, there is plenty of veiled goddesses and stuff that it could be referring to as well in some way. And I find that interesting. So what is the mother then? What is the lady? So if you have the father, spirit, who's in earth, all possibilities, but, you know, unmanifested potentialities, then you need something to manifest these potentialities. And so this kind of merging of the spirit and matter, the divine father and the divine mother coming together, because they are opposites. It's the, you know, the conjunction of opposites, as Jung would talk about, or many other places talk about. And within that, the fulfillment of everything within that, like a great love affair, the proper idea of soulmates, where the people who have missing parts and are complete when they come together. And it's this kind of sense of deep love for one, for each, the other person, but to feel that they're, to me, it feels like they are separate, they're two different things. Which, like, when I say that I don't think that, you know, I am God or whatever, I also don't think I'm the goddess, even though I have aspects of the goddess, like clearly I have a material body. So I am a theist, but I think there's two of them. There's a mother and a father, and I think they're as divine as each other and as important as each other. And if anything, the mother is more important and probably more ancient. There's a thing recently I read or seen on TikTok, and I went to look for it today and I couldn't find it. And it's about that a certain translation of the opening of Genesis suggests that if you actually translate it properly, that God talks about the firmament being there before he starts creation. It's hard to know. You come across these things every so often, and you know, immediately find someone who debunks it, and it can feel quite, I suppose, satisfactory at the time, and then you go, oh, that's not it. But it was kind of interesting that it came up while I was looking through all of these things, because it wasn't something I was looking for in research. I was just on TikTok wasting my life. And this notion that in my vision, going back to my other vision or my experience, what God said, that it was like this when he woke up, that this was here. And so I think the mother is the great mystery. I mean, and we have this kind of notion that it's, you know, the spirit, the father, we'll return to father. It's that notion of, you know, the prodigal son and all that. And it's like, okay, but there's a lot about that I reject. I have issues with that story, but we'll bracket that for a minute and come back to that in another way. But that even the mother is a mystery to God. I find that fascinating. I find that something about that rings absolutely true. And I think at the point where these two come together, before anything else, I think that's where, if you want to have like a personality of God, and you know, people talk about, particularly the Hare Krishnas, will talk about the supreme personality of the Godhead, or that there's some sort of personality or form that you can interact with. I think that happens then and not beforehand. It's when the conjoining of the mother and the father, the spirit and matter, makes the Lord and the Lady possible, which is like a personality or approach that you can have. And I think there's a possibility that we all get our own. Krishna certainly, you know, every gopi that Krishna hangs out with, let's say, each get their own. You have a personal relationship with the God or the Goddess or the Lord and the Lady. So and I feel that to be true. But I think it happens at that moment. That's when that comes together, when the kind of moment of bringing things together. And so the mother then being as, you know, the manifest universe, what does that completely entail? You know, it's like sometimes described as, you know, spirit impregnates the mother. This is the womb, which, you know, it works as a kind of a metaphor. The interesting thing, I think, about the way that we kind of look at matter is that we would think that our mind is in some way separate from it. But theosophy and a lot of the Vedic literature would say, and Buddhism would say, that no, the mind is part of the material world. It's not your soul. It's not the spirit. It's, you know, it's part of the material world. And in that way, that it's a tool, a bridging tool between spirit and matter or whatever. But it gets more complicated when the third aspect of this trinity comes into it. But it's just trying to work out, where exactly is the animating principle as shown? The animating principle, I mean the father. Where is that in the world? You know, is it just a spark that, you know, when someone dies, you immediately know that that thing's gone? Or is it part of, is some of the desires, is some of the creativity, is that part of it? And I find that hard to kind of find exactly where that line is. But it would feel that this, when we talk about places like idea space or inspiration or things coming to you, would definitely be the spirit, but kind of the intellect stuff. And as I said, it's called active intelligence in theosophy, this mother principle, the thinking, the working out, you know, the desires in the sense of wanting food, sex, that kind of thing would probably be under the domain of the mother. But it's a whole kind of thing that I have to really sit and go, where exactly is the delineation between the father and the mother? And it's going to be hard because there is going to be overlap. And the joining of them is, you know, two massively divine beings in contemplation of each other and what that means. And trying to understand it is probably impossible or, you know, not a great idea. So come back to my kind of really shoehorning in these things into the three gunas. What would the mother then be? It'd be Rajas, which is the second, it's the better one up from Tamas. And this is usually seen as passion and creativity and, you know, getting up and going and doing stuff or whatever. So this would suggest, if this is true, if this is a proper correlation between three gunas and the trinity, let's say, then I would say that creativity would be under the domain of the mother. And this would probably bear out in the idea of the, you know, Shakti in Tantra, which is the kind of creative impulse of Shiva. But I'd say there's a bit more. I'd say it's the possibility of creativity comes because of the combining. And then you would have to ask, well, where is magic in all of that? And I think magic it comes in the third principle. But just before we get there, if you go to the Wikipedia page for Rajas, you will find that some of the words that it uses to describe Rajas is, it's neither good or bad, which you could say about the material world. It helps to actualize the other two gunas, which is interesting because that is what the mother would be doing. It helped to actualize the spirit and, you know, by through that creates the child. It is individualizing. It is driven. It is moving. It's dynamic. It's change. It's birth. It's creation. It's generation. Using those cherry-picked words, I can make a good argument that Rajas would in some way correlate with the mother. So then, to sum up the mother or matter or active intelligence, the active principle, I would see it then as the body in which spirit joins with and animates. It's the manifesting, it's the womb, It is the body, and it's the combination of these two principles that make the child, or the creative world, or the entire of creation. And I feel that the bigger mystery out of all three of them, possibly, is the mother, and probably the most ancient, and the thing that gets neglected the most, and the one who does the biggest sacrifice out of all of it, and is the one that is turned away from the most, and will probably not look at you until you start looking at her. And so the child, and I want to finish with the vision that I had rather than start with it this time, because there's a good chance that I may get emotional around it, and I don't want to then continue to have to try to explain what the child is while being emotional, because I got very emotional when it happened. The child is probably, out of all of them, the hardest one for me to explain, because it depends on what viewpoint you're looking at, or perspective, or what vantage point, or what you're trying to do exactly. So the child is you, and the child is me, and I see myself as the child. I am a child of God and the goddess. Not just, you know, it's the coming together of these two things. But it can also be seen as it's humanity as a whole. It can also be seen as the planet as a whole. It can also be seen as an atom. It can be any part of the manifest universe that has, you know, become together with the formation of spirit and matter, you know, the mother and father coming together to create this third entity. And I think the different notions of kind of non-duality and animism and all that, you know, live very well in this kind of arena of, you know, where humanity is one unit, the world is one unit, you know, the solar system is one unit, everything has the, you know, a quality of God within it, everything has a spirit. Because of that, then this third quality emerges that is only available between the merging of the conjunction of opposites of the mother and the father, which is the soul. And what is the soul? The soul is kind of your awareness, consciousness, you know, essentially that. If we were to look at the bastardization of my continued bastardization of the three gunas, the quality of the child in this sense would be sattva. Sattva is the quality of balance, harmony, goodness, purity, universalizing, holistic, constructive, creative, building, positive attitude, luminous serenity, beingness, peaceful, virtuous. According to the Wikipedia page, there's plenty other versions of the three gunas, and some of them just absolutely wouldn't work within this this scheme. And so this is what I was trying to get at originally in the Universal Disciple and the Light Magician blog post that I put up, whatever, that this is the work of why we are here. It's not to escape, not to run away. It's to look the mother in the eyes and make the world better for her, so that her great sacrifice is worth it. You know, it's to bring what was in the dark, and only in the dark, into the light. And that can only happen here. Your insights, your awakenings, your creativity, your magic, all of these things can only happen here. You know, it's like you have the choice then, I suppose, to make it worse or make it better. And I would say, given that the conjunction of the mother and the father and the lord and lady seems to be, at least to me, a hugely massive love affair, where deeply love each other, that then it wouldn't out of that want to create something terrible. But because he is on all possibilities, then there is, and because she is material with no spirit, all things can and will come out as clearly, you know, things that aren't as satisfactory as we'd want them to be. So then the goal of us, if you so choose it, and if you so agree with it, or you align with it, is that you have to bring the light into the world. I know that's very kind of new agey, and you know, yeah, we know all this. But I think that is the truth. I mean, the old Madhva, if I'm pronouncing that, religion of, you know, or Zoroastrian, they had this kind of notion that there was a huge battle between darkness and light, which in some ways I do feel that, you know, that makes sense, that, you know, there is the darkness of the inert spirit, and we are trying to make this place light, you know, that we are the light in the sense, the soul is the light. But I don't see that as it like being evil and good or whatever. It's just kind of the nature of the place in which we find ourselves is, I'm not getting into the problem of evil right this moment. Let's also bracket that. But their notion was that your work then was that you had to do the work, the good, make the good in all possibility. And what does this look like? Well, to me, it's aim for increasing good thoughts, good words and good deeds. It's to strive for kindness in every moment, and always be honest with yourself and others. And in making decisions, try to act in everyone's best interest rather than just your own. You know, serve humanity and not just myself, and make the choice within every moment to take the higher order choice, the good choice, the one that brings more light rather than, you know, brings more darkness. And to see that our spiritual journey, our awakenings, our pursuit of wanting whatever it is that we're pursuing, our magic, our creativity, our art, our music, or love is not just for us. It's for them. It's for everyone else. It's for everything else. It's for the Lord and the Lady, and it's for all the children. And to try and come away as much as possible from having this kind of egocentric point of view of my spirituality, my spiritual ideals, my kind of spiritual pursuits, my awakenings, my insights, my music, my art, my joys, or whatever. And it's ours. It's for them. You know, and a devotional or bhakti type thing is to do it all for the greater good, for, if you want, for the divine parents, or for, you know, just for everyone else. I mean, that's not to completely disregard your own kind of wants, needs, and, you know, become a hermit and live under a bridge, but it's just that within it all at the moment, aim for the highest order that you can do and not be so concerned with your own attainments. In the teachings of the Arcane School, which I am part of, it's always been, from the very beginning, it's always been stressed that all spiritual work is group work, and all service is group work, and the whole aim is away from the individual and towards the wider group. Of course, when I first came across that, I hated it. I really did, because it's like, no, it's about me. It's about what I want. And I don't mean like in a very open way that, but it was still at the back of my mind, go, yeah, but what about me, you know? And I think it's a legitimate claim, because if you really just are only ever doing stuff for other people, then it becomes, rather than service, it becomes servitude. And I don't think that's what the call for is. It's a call to think of everyone rather than just yourself. But the group also includes yourself. So it's the highest for all, rather than the highest just for everyone else, or the highest just for me. And you can continue your hopes and your dreams, and, you know, pursue your talents and your creativity and your art and your meditation and your spirituality and all that, but from more of a place of how can I give rather than how can I get? What is the places I can fix? Where's the places I can give love? Where's the places I can bring light? What can I do with my talents and my gifts that is great for everyone, rather than just, you know, shines a light on me? Use your talents, your gifts, your creativity, your magic, your spirituality to shine the light on everyone, including yourself, but on the group. That's how I see it. That's what I aim for anyway. I fail miserably most of the time, but that is the high ideal that I'm aiming towards. And in that, we do this thing, which is the redemption of the material plane. And I had the hardest time, I really did, with this whole idea of redemption. Because redemption to me implies something was bad that then became good. But I think the idea I'm choosing to go with is that, rather than it being redemption, that the mother was something bad, it's that out of this great sacrifice, we can make something good. We can turn the darkness into light. And essentially, that comes from self-expression. That the spirit is trying to express himself, trying to have a self-expressive thing, all potentiality, trying to live up to the potential and all these things. We get this through creativity, get this through art, through music, through all of the different kind of things. It's like, it's the expansion, it's evolution, it's the moving forward. And this was my big issue with the difference between mysticism and magic, is that there's an unbelievable impulse for me to expand and widen into new areas, like novelty, creativity. And that's what I feel magic is, and why I think magic and art are synonymous. And in many ways, arguments can be made, and often are. But that this kind of outward push. But what I failed to notice was that there also needs to be an inward knowing in order for this, a more pure outward push. So that the directionality has to go in both directions. And I think there's a lot of spirituality goes in only one direction. In order to kind of explain this a bit more, I think if we put ourselves in the triangle of the father and the mother, and then with the child at the top, because in Theosophy it's seen as that the child is the second aspect rather than the third, because it's the thing that joins, it's top of the triangle. And if you look at how things can be dysfunctional or whatever, you can see if you just turn the child and only look at the father, then you have dogma, you have self-righteousness, you have blind inertia, you know, you have things that don't change, you have tradition, you have fundamentalism, you know, you have sternness, you have lack of action, inertia, just, you know, not living up to potential, all of that kind of stuff, where preferences and proclivities and prejudices are sold as spiritual qualities, you know. And it's all of this kind of, as I say, just looking at the father, looking at it, is, you know, you can see it, it's in the Christian religion, that's just plainly just the child directed at the father. Now, if you look directly just at the mother, you know, clearly what's the dysfunctional version of that is going to be materialism, and, you know, this kind of gimme, 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 more, more, more attitude of I can be fixed by having more things. All of this, you know, this desire in its most dysfunctional, rather than its creative sense. You know, it's the lower order version of creativity. It's just the desire, rather than desire to evolve and to move out and to, you know, do all of these things. It's desire to have. And I've, you know, there is a dis- a non-dysfunctional version of wanting things too as well. But also you have, you know, materialism, where you completely remove the spirit from everything, and you have the whole kind of rational approach, the scientism approach, all of these things, and that's just where everything is just as it appears and there's nothing more to it. There's no even consciousness, there's no soul, there's no spirit, there's no any of these things. It's all happening in matter that'll eventually die and go away. It's just because you're just clearly just solely looking at the mother and not looking at the father, and that would be the dysfunctional thing. And I suppose then the third thing would be that the child looks at neither of them. And I suppose in one way this would be, I don't know, nihilistic, or, you know, looking into the void or something like that. I don't really know what it is, but it does feel like it's a valid kind of, and also dysfunctional path. And so the synthesis of what the mother and the father coming together is the non-dysfunctional version of just looking at each of them separately. And so infusing the spirit into matter, creativity, desire as a way forward, rather than as trying to fix something or trying to make up for a lack or something like that. In spirituality, we can be quite hard to desire and saying that suffering will be removed when we stop desiring. And I think some suffering can be removed when we stop some desiring. But I think desiring is an important thing. It's part of looking at the mother, you know, in the eyes. Part of it is in not turning away from the suffering and that comes with desiring. It's the nature of the place in which we find ourselves is that by our desiring leads to suffering. But that's not a good enough excuse to turn away from it. You know, you need some sort of friction. You need something in order to evolve, to grow and to move, and to not kind of engage with the suffering. It's not to bring it on, you know, bring it on, come on, I'll have all the suffering. It's not that. There's plenty there. You don't need to. But it means that for growth to happen and for new things to appear, for magic to form, for creativity, for all these things to happen, then there's going to be pain with that. There's going to be turmoil. There's going to be all of these things. But that's part of it. That's the nature of it. That's not to be run away from or say that it's, you know, it's ignorant to be in this kind of a state or something like that. And so the vision, and I'll end it then on this, there's a thing where this vision starts, which isn't necessarily completely and utterly related to the whole thing, but it is in the sense of it ties back to the vision of the rat and the mother in the boat and the thing. This is from when I was doing the Yeaters, and it's number 4, it's Paz, and it really ramped up at this point. It felt like that the first kind of 20, 25, possibly 24 were just preparatory to get you to this stage where the last couple of ones were going to really, really hit you with the good stuff. And I completely haven't unpacked the last ones at all. There's so much in it that, you know, you could spend, and I will spend the rest of my life trying to understand it. And I listened to it in the order, these things. So I had listened to the previous vision of the mother before I listened to this one, even though this one happened long before the mother. This was last year sometime. There's a part where it goes into a field just before the section I want to talk about. And it reminds me, this is the rat field. And it was a field that I had beside where I grew up, the house before, and it was just an open field, but we call it the rat field because I assume someone once saw a rat or something like that. But then there was this notion that it says, remember that this was mentioned in previously, this was mentioned in another vision or something like that. Just carried on. I didn't know what that was at the time. But hadn't listened to this in the sequence of what I did meant that this was mentioned in the other one. But that had happened after. It was mentioned, the rat was mentioned again in a vision or an act of imagination or journey that happened months after this. But correctly predicted the order in which I listened to it on that day, which, you know, you can take or leave, and synchronicities and things like this are for me, you know, for their individual, they're not for you. And when you explain the profoundness of something to someone else, they'll go, yeah, that doesn't make any sense, but it's the feeling that's attached to it. So while it probably doesn't seem as profound to you, it was like, holy God, holy goddess at the time. That was so later, this moves into then, from this field, I move over stream and I end up talking to this kind of he's like, it starts off as the horned god, which was a huge symbolism as part of the Aethers when I was doing it. But then he turns into a kind of a more wizardy, fathery, beard, Gandalf-y type figure. And he's just sitting then sitting in the forest and in kind of an embankment kind of a thing. And he just calls me over and he's rubbing me and he's holding me and he's telling me everything is okay. And, you know, I'm just so happy. Like, you know, I feel absolutely secure and it's going to be hard to get through because I'm just quite emotional. So, because it was a very profound experience, even thinking about it now. And I'm just sitting on his knee, you know, and I'm a small child, and I'm just so happy to be there. And I'm so happy to be beside him. And I'm like a kid, totally in awe. Like I'm wide-eyed, innocent, uncorrupted, I suppose, in some ways. You know, a beautiful, inquisitive, just everything that a child is. And absolutely just loving being in the presence of, you know, the father. And I'm just in love with the world. And he says, like, points around it, you know, like this is all yours, all of this, pointing to the forest or whatever was around us, the whole thing. And then we kind of walk through this tall grass, or like as if you're walking through a field of, you know, wheat or grain or something like that, some sort of crop, but it's grass. That's the way it describes it. And he turns then into a witch, and she's got red hair. And that's the way I describe it, it's the witch. So it was the wizard and the witch. It's the lord, the lady, the father, the mother, whatever. You know, they're the same. And it's, you know, she's very, very pleasant, very loving. And she's holding my hand. You know, like those kind of the cliche images that you've seen on Instagram and TikTok and all that, where there's like the girl is holding the man's hand and they're, you know, they make 50 photos in different places, but it's that kind of angle of it. You know, she's pulling me through this grass or whatever. But then it immediately kind of switches to another scene, which is of me being pulled along, kind of dragged through the mud, and I'm a soldier and I'm being dragged. I'm not fully dead, but I'm like losing consciousness. I'm on my way. And there was a lot of kind of elements and themes and images of like World War One or war or something previous, earlier on in the scrying. And it's kind of then switching through this lovely scene of the mother walking with me lovingly through the, you know, this grass, holding my hand, to cutting back to the soldier being dragged along, you know, like as if I've been injured, or I assume they feel I've been killed, and I'm being dragged, as it turns out, into this truck, the back of the truck, and I'm thrown into this truck, and in this back of the truck is loads of other dead bodies, and there's the two guys who were dragging me. There's one guy who was dragging me, but there was another guy, and they both got into the truck, and it's, you know, we're still switching as this happens, switching back and forth between the vision of the mother and this kind of battlefield thing. And then it pulls out and it drives off. The truck drives off, and it's like beside a beach, and it's moving along, and it, you know, it's like kind of a bird's eye view of the whole thing, and the water is kind of grey, misty, and very evocative of the kind of water scene that was in the other vision, and then I can see that I'm sitting as the truck moves off and flies along, I'm moving down, and the wizard, the witch, and me are just sitting on the embankment beside the road or whatever. And he's throwing stones into the water. And, the whole sense of the whole thing is that we're trying to avoid what's going to happen next. And I'm sitting between him and this embankment. And, you know, we're a family. And the wizard, the father, as he's throwing the stones into the water, he just keeps saying, "This is the way it is. This is the way it is." And he hugs me. And he pats me on the back. And then I get a huge hug from the witch, the mother, the lady. And she's trying her best not to get sad, as I am now too. And she's putting on a brave face for me. And she starts rubbing my shoulders. But you can tell that she doesn't really want to look at me because it makes her so sad. And I know that I have to leave them. That we only get this very, very brief moment to be together. And so I stand up. And I assume you can tell how emotional this was, given that this is months and months later, trying to talk about it. And I'm as emotional as I was during it. And I know I have to leave them. I have to stand up and I have to walk. I have to walk this road by myself. And so I get up and I start walking on the road. And I'm walking away and getting further and further away from them. And they're getting further and further away from me. And I'm still a child, remember? All alone, on my own, walking the road. And I turn around one last time to look at them. And then I walk into the light. Well, we got through that last section. It did take me a while to record it. I'm sure you will hear, though I will edit it as much as possible to make it a bit coherent, just how emotional I got through that. And it was a very, very emotional experience. And just to go back to what I said at the beginning of it, that these things are available to all of you if you so choose them. You know, they can catch you off guard with how immensely powerful they all are or whatever. Like that happened, I don't know, months ago, and still I feel it as deeply, that separation, that sense of loss and sadness and the brief time that we have. And it fills me with a lot of humbleness too, and gratitude and all of these things. But it's deeply emotional, and it's certainly profound experience. And I hope I did it justice. I hope I did justice to my kind of train of thought with all of this, but I assume I haven't. And I assume a lot of that is to do with the fact that it's not fully coherent in my brain as much as I want to. But part of doing the podcast and doing the things I do is by putting it out there, I find myself being able to understand myself a bit more as well. And hopefully then in some way you good people of the internet get something out of it. Even as I said at the beginning, it's just that, well, it's not that. I'm not into that. And so that, yeah, that feels good that I can put a pin in this, because like I was saying the last episode, it was like I want to be open to all things. So now I'm going to just drop all of that for a while and not have that as my, you know, the thing that I have to concentrate on, and just see what then develops out of it, having now placed it all together and presented it in some sort of package, even though, you know, not exemplary by any means. I think out of all of them, I probably let the child section down the most. But I will put links to stuff in the show description, including the post that I was talking about, the Universal Disciple and the Child, or the Light Magician. There's a lot of stuff that I don't agree with, but I feel I added stuff to it. There's a theosophical bent to it, that, you know, a cyclical thing. This whole idea, the conclusion is the whole idea is that we're trying to grow the child to be another god. And maybe so, but I've become more and more kind of aware with my study into, you know, more Hindu and Vedic stuff, and particularly the Bhagavad Gita, which I've become absolutely obsessed with recently. And that line in the Bhagavad Gita goes, well, everyone has existed for all time. You know, you have always been here, I've always been here, this place has always been here. And so I don't know if it is cyclical. But I do, out of all of this, definitely have a more personal relationship with the Lord and the Lady, which I love. I'm quite devotional in nature when it comes to my spirituality, and that was deeply missing from a lot of the stuff that I was kind of absorbing or moving into. And in fact, it was like the opposite direction of what I actually wanted. So when I sat down with it and trying to, you know, work it all out, what is it that I'm feeling, what's trying to express through me or whatever. And so I offer this as an act of service. The whole point of service is that you do it without, you know, hope of getting anything personal out of it, you know, that in some way helps other people, or helps it certainly has helped me. So I've already failed, because, you know, I've helped myself already. But yeah, if you would like to hear more incomplete and possibly incoherent ramblings from a middle-aged Irish man with regards to spirituality, magic, and all the worlds around it, or you like my art or my music and you'd like me to make more of it, I'd like to make more of it, or just like me to continue doing what I do, then please do consider signing up to the Patreon, sending a donation, looking at my book list, buying me a book, sharing the stuff, or, you know, just sending me a nice word of encouragement. All of these things are deeply, I am grateful for when they happen, and do absolutely allow me to continue to do what I do. And I'm a very privileged person to be able to self-express and express myself in the way that I have been gifted the last number of years. And I'm really appreciative, but it does involve generous people allowing it. So, I mean, these are great, wonderful people, and I love all of you. That was a deeply emotional episode, and hopefully not all episodes will be as deeply emotional or take me weeks and weeks of putting it all together. So, good people of the internet, my blessing for you is I hope that you find a cosmology that suits you, and I hope you feel loved by divinity or the universe or whatever it is that you subscribe to in the way that I currently do, and that you find that the world has deep, deep, deep meaning even in the places where we feel it isn't, and that you no longer feel the need to try to escape, but rather to engage actively and make the place better for those who come after us and those who are also here at the same time. So good people of the internet, may our best days be ahead, and be well.